Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, I know I wanted to talk about this administration, but I think that will only take a very short amount of time. I didn't realize my days are running tonight, guys. I literally didn't realize until my boss said, well, tomorrow I need you to come in at 2. You know, you're my strongest, chef for the day, so I need you here earlier. So I didn't realize. Well, I had to come in on my day off today. So I did not realize that tomorrow is, in fact, Thanksgiving. Now, my family were not, throughout my lifetime, yes. They did the Thanksgiving thing and all that. They went through the motions and all that. But we don't celebrate Thanksgiving here at this house. In my home, I do not celebrate Thanksgiving. I celebrate Native heritage. Now, what we're going to do today for our Thanksgiving special, because tomorrow I'll be at work for the evening, and we're doing our tarot show tomorrow morning. So we're going to do our little Thanksgiving special tonight, which will have a little bit of, a little bit of whatever. Whatever the case may be. Who knows? We might cut it short and do a political show after all. But first, before we fucking deal with anything of the now, I want to tell you guys the true story of Pocahontas. Now, she wasn't even a teenager when John Smith claimed she saved him from execution. Whether the story happened the way Smith tells it or even at all, it's up for debate. Now, Pocahontas might be a household name, but the true story of her short but powerful life has been buried in myths that have persisted since the 17th century. To start with, Pocahontas wasn't even her actual name. She was born about 1596, and her real name was Amanut, and she also had a more private name, Matoka. Pocahontas was her nickname, which, depending on who you ask, means playful one or ill-behaved child. Now, Pocahontas was the favorite daughter of Powhatan. I'm sorry, Powhatan. Let's make sure we say that correctly and give him the respect that he has earned. Now, he was the formidable ruler of the more than 30 Algonquin-speaking tribes in and around the area that the early English settlers would claim as Jamestown, Virginia, which years later, after no one was able to dispute the facts, John Smith wrote about how she, the beautiful daughter of a powerful native leader, rescued him, an English adventurer, from being executed by her father, which wasn't true at all. This narrative of Pocahontas turning her back on her own people and allying with the English, thereby finding common ground between the two cultures, has endured for centuries. But in actuality, Pocahontas' life was much different than how Smith or mainstream culture tells it. It's even disputed whether or not she was 11 or 12. Even rescued the mercantile soldier and explorer at all. In fact, she was one of the first indigenous women who have been taken, and she's not the last, because indigenous women go missing more than any other nationality. and no one looks for them but their family. So Smith may have misinterpreted what was actually a ritual ceremony or even just lifted the tale from the popular Scottish ballad. Now, 400 years after her death, the story of the real Pocahontas is finally being accurately explored. Now, representatives and curators from the Pamunkey tribe of Virginia, the descendants of Pocahontas, offer expert testimony to paint a picture of a spunky, cartwheeling Pocahontas who grew up to be a clever and brave young woman, serving as a translator, ambassador, and leader in her own right in the face of European power. Now, Pocahontas has been so distorted for so long, and why her true legacy is vital to understand today is more than we could ever know. And you know, it's not just Disney who gets her story wrong. It goes back to John Smith, who marketed the relationship as a love story. What class and cultural factors have allowed that myth to persist to white people? So the story that Pocahontas was head over heels in love with John Smith has lasted for many generations. He mentioned it himself in the colonial period, as you say, then it died, but it was born again after the revolution in the early 1800s, and when we were really looking for nationalist stories, ever since then it's lived in one form or another, especially right up to the Disney movie that we know today. You know, I think the reason it's been so popular, not among Native Americans, but among the people of dominant culture, is that it's very flattering to the white people, the idea that this is a good Indian. She admires the white man, admires Christianity, admires the culture, wants to have peace with these people, and is willing to live with these people rather than her own people. Marry him rather than one of her own. That whole idea makes people in white America feel good about their history. This is the watered-down history for white consumption. Take two. Now, now that we know that we have gotten this history really wrong, we need to get down to the bottom of the tea. Let's sip on this tea. In 1616, Pocahontas, baptized as Rebecca and married to John Wolfe, left for England before she could return to Virginia. She fell ill. She died in England, possibly of pneumonia or tuberculosis. And she was buried at St. George's Church on March 21st, 1617. But in real life, Pocahontas was a member of the Pamunkey tribe. How do the Pamunkey and the other native people tell her story today? And it's pretty interesting in general. Until recently, Pocahontas has not been a popular figure among Native Americans. What you hear mostly, for example, is reactions of groans because they were just so tired. Native Americans for so many years have been so tired of enthusiastic white people loving to love Pocahontas and patting themselves on the back because they love Pocahontas, when in fact, what they were really loving was the story of an Indian who virtually worshipped white culture. They were tired of it, and they didn't believe it, and to them, it seemed unrealistic. Now, I want to say that there's been a change recently, and partly, but the Disney movie, ironically, helped that. Even though it conveyed more myths, the Native American character is the star. She's the main character. And she's interesting, strong, and beautiful, and so young. But Native Americans are not in love with that movie because that's not what happened. The lesson passed down by mainstream culture that by leaving her people and adopting Christianity, Pocahontas became a model of how to bridge cultures. What do you think are the real lessons that can be learned from Pocahontas' life? Well, she was stolen, for one. For two, she was married to a white man who is a pedophile. that married her. So, I really, there's so many stories like this. I can't say that I'm one who likes Thanksgiving, but we're going to get to where Thanksgiving came from. So let's get to the bottom of Thanksgiving. Now, I want to say she was stolen from her home. She did not fucking leave her people. She did not worship the white men. In fact, they stole her. They basically took her and married her little tiny person to, and he didn't even marry her. I don't even think it was him who married her. I want to say this is wrong when it came to her being married to John Smith. She married to someone else. So, Matoka, you had such a short life and it was taken from you, and I'm so sorry. Yes, come in, Matilda. Come in. Come in. Open the door. You're just playing. Okay, come in.
Hi.
Hi, come in. You gonna come in and listen to the show? Okay, she's not staying. Hello? Okay. Oh, yeah? Now, what you all learned about the first thing, you want to shut the door? Shut the door. You can come in here, just shut the door. Yeah, that's fine, just shut the door. Yay! So anyway, the Thanksgiving that we've all grown up to know is actually completely wrong. Now, the meeting between the Massasoit Ossa Semiquin, Grand Sachem of the Winnipeg, and Pilgrim leader Governor William Bradford. Now, this pair negotiated an agreement that allowed the Pilgrims to settle in Patuxent, now called Plymouth. Now, after a summer of racial reckoning, is the country finally ready to learn the truth? Now, traditional story of Thanksgiving, and by extension, the Pilgrims, the one repeated in the history books in school, and even the Peanuts treatment in a Charlie Brown's Thanksgiving, doesn't start in 1620. With the cold and seasick pilgrims stepping off the Mayflower onto Plymouth Rock. It also doesn't start a year later, with the pilgrims and the native, the Wampanoag, all sitting together to break bread and celebrate their first successful harvest and a long, harmonious relationship to come. It doesn't start there, because those things never happen, despite being immortalized in American mythos for generations. The pilgrims spent only a few weeks of 1620 in the Wampanoag village of Patuxent, which they would rename Plymouth, and now certainly didn't step off onto Plymouth Rock. As for the last 1621 feast, the supposed genesis of today's Thanksgiving tradition, there was a small feast, but the Wampanoag were not invited. They showed up later. Their role in helping the pilgrims survive by sharing resources and wisdom went unacknowledged that day, according to the accounts of the toast given by the pilgrim leaders. Now, the first National Thanksgiving Day did not invoke the pilgrims at all. In 1863, President Abraham Lincoln declared a Thanksgiving Day on the last Thursday of November, looking to reconcile a country in the throes of civil war. On the parallel track, the story of the Pilgrim forefathers coming to the New World and founding America for religious freedom gained steam, as New England Protestants wielded the myth to gain the top spot in the country's cultural hierarchy above Catholics and immigrants, according to the historian David Silverman. In the book, This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, the Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. As Americans looked for an origin story that wasn't soaked in the blood of Native Americans or built on the backs of slavery, the humble, bloodless story of the 102 pilgrims forging a path in the New World in search of religious freedom was just what they needed. According to Silverman, regardless of whether it was rooted in historical fact, it became accepted as such. In 1963, these two tracks crossed when President John F. Kennedy, whose family frolicked in the home of the native Nauset and Aquinnah people on Cape Cod, and Martha's Vineyard immortalized them in his own Thanksgiving Day proclamation, baking the plats together like the broken bread and shared in the mythic first Thanksgiving feast. The historically accurate story of the Pilgrims and the founding of Plymouth Colony 400 years ago this month is not in the most history books. No, I never learned about it. It also is not the one you'll find at Pilgrim Memorial Park in Plymouth, home of the famed Plymouth Rock and the Mayflower II, a replica of the cargo ship turned people carrier the Pilgrims crammed into to cross the Atlantic. The more historically accurate telling is gaining a foothold in small circles as members of the Herring Pond, Mashpee, and Aquinnah Winnipeg tribes. Yeah, stay right there. Michelle Picoraro, executive director of Plymouth 400, who is helping lead the anniversary commemoratum, and Silverman bring the documented facts to light. Now, how are we supposed to improve on this sorry record if we don't understand this sorry record? I think the only way forward is to understand the history the way that it happened. This was said by Stephen Peters, a spokesman for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, and he and other Mashpee and Herring Pond Wampanoag tribe members have been working with museums and on platforms such as Vimeo to elevate the history of the indigenous people who lived in the region for thousands of years before the Pilgrims arrived. At that point, it really changes your perspective. Now, hostility, slavery, and pandemic. Tradition dictates that Pilgrim stories start in September 1620 with the departure... The departure of the Mayflower, packed with colonists and sailors leaving England to set sail for the New World, but starting there ignores years of European contact with the native people of New England and paints a Wampanoag and their neighbors in the broad stroke of simplicity, ignoring the complex regional relationships and potlucking at play. Now, the story could start a century earlier, in 1524. Now, this was the first known contact between Native Americans in southern New England and Europeans, Narragansett Bay, near Aquidneck Island. Or it could start in 1602, when Bartholomew Gosnold visited Cape Cod and what's known as Martha's Vineyard, where the contact with the Wampanoag started with the trading and ending in violence, as Silverman writes in his book. Future annual encounters between the two would follow this same high-tension pattern. Or in 1614, when the Nauset Cape Cod tribe, the member named Epinal was captured by Europeans and kept in bondage for 3 years. He engineered an escape and returned to his people on Martha's Vineyard. That same year, Tisquantum, who spent time in Spain and London, would later return to Patuxent, and he and Epinal would play important roles in the burgeoning Wampanoag Pilgrims relations. Only Squanto was immortalized in the Pilgrims story. But perhaps the best starting point, according to Peters and other historians, is 1616, when the lethal pandemic tore through many Wampanoag villages In 3 years, once populous villages like Pawtuxet, where the pilgrims would eventually settle, were utterly void of people. The white man brought disease. Kind of like now, all the white people coming to my store are bringing disease, probably. Yeah, I know. I said it. Now, as English explorer Thomas Germer wrote, further threatening the existence of Wampanoag, the Narragansett tribe, their powerful western rivals, were left largely untouched. "We weren't used to diseases here," said Hazel Kearns, an elder with the Herring Pond Wampanoag tribe, which lived in Pawtuxet. "Our systems were not used to the illnesses that came with the Europeans and pilgrims." Now a nation diminished, the pilgrims' arrival in Provincetown 400 years spawned a clash of cultures. The Mayflower impacted in the beginning of American democracy on Cape Cod. So by 1620, the Wampanoag, as Peters describes, were in a difficult spot, shaped by years of volatile contact with Europeans, slavery, regional threats to their power, a mysterious, devastating illness. Now, for me, that's a really important place to start because you can understand that big decisions were made. It would have been a hugely complex situation. Why Massasoit helped the pilgrims? Now, when the Mayflower anchored off what is now known as Provincetown, the pilgrims found themselves not in a vast, untouched land held for them by divine providence, but amid indigenous people wary and distrustful of Europeans and the complex politics of rival tribes. It's hard to separate the pilgrims from what the United States would eventually become. It's easy to believe they arrived here seeking religious freedom and intending to eventually form their own country based on those ideals. But many white Americans hold it very dear, the idea that the main impetus for colonization was a search for religious freedom. If you ask the general public, even educated people, what's the most common explanation? It's not right. The congregation of Puritans within the Pilgrims did break off from the Church of England for religious reasons. But that brought them to Holland, where they were free to practice their religion. After a decade of struggling to find jobs and fearing the Dutch influence on their children, the congregants sought a charter from the London Company to start a colony in America, although it was originally granted for land around the mouth of the Hudson River. The pilgrims' main concerns were their own survival in the New World and turning a profit for those who backed the venture. That survival was made possible with the help from the Wampanoag, the peace left unsaid at the feast that would become Thanksgiving. Now, the decision to help the pilgrims whose ill had been raiding native villages and enslaving their people for nearly a century came after they stole native food and seed stores and dug up native graves, pocketing funerary offerings as described by pilgrim leader Edward Winslow in Mount's Relation, A Journey of the Pilgrims at Plymouth, which was published in 1622. That decision was made by Osamequin, more commonly known as Massasoit, which means Great Second, in a structure that Peter says was far closer to the democratic government than the pilgrim government. Wampanoag territory was organized into sachemships, each with a sachem, a leader who could oversee that particular village. Now, sachems ruled the will of the people. Each ship was independent, but had relationships with the other sachem ships, all coming under the purview of the Great Sachem. Now, Massasoit had gone through a bit of a rebrand, in the ensuing centuries to be painted as a protector and preserver of the pilgrims, as it says in the statue dedicated to him overlooking Plymouth Rock. But his decision to allow the pilgrims to stay at Pawtuxet and eventually provide them aid after they were driven off the Cape, Peter said, had less to do with the sense of dutiful benevolence and more to do with careful weighing of circumstances and outcomes. Now, Mashpee, Wampanoag, and Plymouth Plantation Site Supervisor Philip Wynne scraped out a pine mishoon, and he literally, basically, he built them a boat and helped them escape. He helped them make a 16-foot white pine mishoon and helped them escape, basically. Now, driving off or killing the pilgrims, as many tribes, including the Nauset, specifically Epinal, wanted to do so, was a valid option. Now, from their point of view, whatever benefit they might gain would not be worth the threat of betrayal, violence, or enslavement that seemed to follow contact with the Europeans. But it would cost valuable warriors in short supply after the pandemic, and there was a risk of Europeans returning in the overwhelming numbers, or worse, sailing around the Outer Cape to take their guns, knives, and armor to the Narragansett tribe, their warring tribe. Now, allowing the pilgrims to settle and establish diplomatic relations with them, even providing aid, brought risks, but also rewards. The guns, knives, and armor the pilgrims carried without intimidating would intimidate the enemies, and it would threaten the Wampanoag territory. So after generations of trading second-hand and third-hand coveted European goods from neighboring native peoples, the Wampanoag would finally gain a first-hand source and considerable trading power. Now, Massasoit weighed the risks and concluded it was better to have danger on his side than have to face it. We needed a friend, Peter said. We needed an ally, and that would have been a really difficult decision for them to make. Very true. The Wampanoag and the Pilgrims, which was a deal with a meal. As these debates were happening among the Wampanoag, the Pilgrims, most of whom were still living in the cramped and creaky Mayflower, struggled to survive the winter. Half of them died of illness, cold, starvation, or a combination of the three. Now, throughout the season, the Wampanoag made their presence known, but did not approach until February, when Samoset, a visiting Abenaki tribesman from Maine, approached Pilgrim leaders. He spoke English and carried a subtle message. The Wampanoag were ready for peace or war with their new neighbors, and the Pilgrims needed to make their intentions clear. Several weeks later, in late March, diplomatic relationships between the two groups formally opened when Massasoit arrived in Plymouth, his face painted deep red and flanked by about 60 intimidating warriors. With Tiz Quantum acting as a broker, the two groups worked out a kind of alliance through the series of visits, exchanges, and beliefs, at least on the part of the Wampanoag, that this small band of pilgrims would stay just that small. You know, I'm going to tell you right now, why did they have Thanksgiving? They would knock off whole tribes and have a feast to celebrate. That's why I don't celebrate it. I think it's unfair to carry these white narratives, this watered-down history for white consumption. If we want to really, really own up to everything, really change and make a change, we need to understand that the shit that we have done in the past will be repeated. And maybe this is exactly who you are. This is exactly who we are. We've been taking children out of mother's arms. Well, since the beginning of time. Now that we have gotten through a little bit of Native American history, I want to talk about, did anybody know that in my town, my county where I am in Lake County, they're doing mining? And fracking? Anybody know that? I just happened to stumble across this shit. They're keeping this shit a secret. Governor DeSantis needs to fucking stop this shit. We're a fucking peninsula, you stupid fucks. Y'all ever been to Oklahoma? We have earthquakes. More earthquakes than California now. You know why? Fracking. Mining. We have no business. No business. Now, let's see how much time we have left. Let's see what we can do. Now, we do have this is weird. My platform is being weird. We're going to end this show, and I'm going to come back on and make sure this happens. So we'll be right back.